I knew Julia very well. She was my great aunt, or some people call her my grand aunt. I'm not sure which is right. Her husband, Paul, was the twin brother of my grandfather, Charles Child. And Paul and Julia never had kids of their own, but they had a lot of what I think of as surrogate children and grandchildren. And so my sisters and my cousins and I were lucky enough to be amongst that group, and we spent quite a bit of time with Paul and Julia. My parents live in New York. The Childs lived here in Cambridge. We have a family house in Maine. We would see each other here and there. And then the Childs also had a house in the south of France, a little house they called La Pichoune, which was right outside of Cannes. And I opened the book with my introduction talking about the summer of 1976. That summer was the bicentennial here. It was also the Montreal Olympics. And Julia had done a TV show about the bicentennial celebration. President Ford had invited Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip that year. There was a state dinner. And it was a really big deal. It was white tie. They had hundreds of guests. They had a beautiful white tent in the Rose Garden. And then about 5 minutes before the dinner started, a terrible rainstorm came and hit Washington, practically washed the tent away, knocked all the TV cameras out, soaked Julia. It was an inauspicious beginning. Julia ran back to the hotel, changed, went back and completed the telecast. And traditionally, at the end of a state dinner, there is entertainment. Ford, in all of his wisdom, chose the Captain and Tennille, who sang such hits as Muskrat Love, which Julia did not think was queenly, and let it be known, and many of her viewers agreed. Right after that, she flew to France, and our family met her there. And it was a poignant time because in 1974, Paul had an emergency bypass operation, and it hadn't gone well. The oxygen was starved to his brain, and he had lost a lot of his great physical ability, his beautiful handwriting, his ability to speak fluent French, and it had been a very dark time for the Childs. And so by the summer of 76, he was finally sort of emerging from a fog, and it was kind of a crucial moment for Julia. And I was 15 at the time. I didn't realize this. We were just in France for the first time, having a great time. I was teaching myself how to drive in the field below their house, inspired by the Formula One cars in Monaco down the street. I was grinding the gears and chasing the goats around, and I only put one dent in the fender. The reason it was a big deal for Julia is that starting in 1970, she got to a point where she was feeling constricted by classical French cuisine and the French chef persona. And she decided to break away. And that meant sundering her relationship with her old French friend, Simca Beck, getting away from performing as the French chef. She began to write in the first person and tell personal stories for the first time. It was a real break from the past, and she called it throwing off the straitjacket of the French chef and her past, and she embraced her American roots. She was living in Cambridge, right around the corner, on Irving Street behind Harvard Yard. She had gone to Smith College. Her mother was raised in Western Massachusetts, and so she was very proud of her Yankee roots. And she decided to embrace that side of herself and started to cook recipes from all over the world and really found her voice. And in 1975, right before we went to visit them in France, she had produced a book called From Julia Child's Kitchen. And this was a kind of a watershed point in her career. The sort of before and after that book are the subject of this book. And from then on, once she'd found her voice, her career went off in a totally different direction. And it's really a remarkable and inspiring story. She was 63 years old in 1975 when the book came out. And for those of you who've read her memoir, you know that she'd already transformed herself once when she was in her late 30s and early 40s. When Paul had taken her to France for the first time, she fell in love with French cooking and had written the book that ultimately became Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Came back to the States, got herself on television, became a celebrity as the French chef, won an Emmy, won a Peabody, was on the cover of Time magazine, was doing things that most people don't do, really kind of creating her career by instinct. And so what's important about that summer of 76 was Paul was sort of coming out of his recovery. Julia had launched this new voice of hers, this first-person voice, where she was telling you stories from her own life, using recipes from all over the place. And she started to just take off and reach the height of her celebrity. I thought I'd read you a little section. So Julia, Mastering the Art of French Cooking was published in October of 1961. And in 1962, she went on to WGBH and did a show called What I've Been Reading. And that was a book show, and so Julia brought her book, but being Julia, she also brought a hot plate and lots of butter and some eggs, and proceeded to demonstrate the making of an omelet. And she was so intent on that she forgot to mention the title of her book. But enough people wrote in saying, we want more of that tall lady cooking, that the heads of WGBH looked at each other and said, well, maybe a cooking show would work. At the time, it was a very small, underfunded station run mostly by volunteers. It's come a long way since then. And so Julia did a series of pilots. And the second pilot was about coq au vin, which is the chicken stew. Now, this is the second time Julia's been on television. And she just had a natural knack for that medium. And having done some TV, I can tell you it's not easy. It's difficult. Her good friend James Beard had a TV show on in the 40s, 1946, and he just was not very comfortable on television. Jacques Pepin wasn't comfortable at first on television, and Julia coached him. It's difficult. But Julia, for whatever reason, I think partially her natural charisma and combined with her deep knowledge of her subject, was great on it. So this is her, a viewer writes in after the second time she's been on television, writing about the coq au vin, and the viewer's name was Irene McHogue, and she wrote, not only did I get a wonderfully refreshing new approach to the preparation and cooking of said poultry, but really and truly one of the most surprisingly entertaining half hours I have ever spent before the TV in many a moon. I loved the way she projected over the camera directly to me, the watcher. Loved watching her catch the frying pan as it almost went off the counter. Loved her looking for the cover of the casserole. It was fascinating to watch her hand motions, which were so firm and sure with the food. And her to-do about the brandy firing was without parallel for that rare tongue-in-cheek sort of humor the viewer longs for in this day of the over-rehearsed ad-lib. Pretty good for your second time on TV. So once Julia found this new voice of hers in 1975, she began to use it quite loudly. She took on Nouvelle Cuisine, which was the big food movement that came from France, declaring itself to be revolutionary and very healthy, and she was a bit skeptical of that. She loudly proclaimed her liberal democratic politics and her support of Planned Parenthood. That annoyed people. And Erica has asked me to read a little section about one of her other targets, which would be vegetarians and nutritionists. So, at a moment when Americans began to worry about cholesterol and cancer and embraced vegetarianism, bottled water, and distance running as prophylactics against those diseases, Julia denounced the food police and the fear of fat mania. She lamented that the dinner table is becoming a trap rather than a pleasure, and predicted that if fear of food continues, it will be the death of gastronomy. At times, Julia could be downright provocative, as when she declared, "The only time to eat diet food is while you're waiting for the steak to cook." Looking back on the vegetarian movement, she said in 1999, "Personally, I don't think pure vegetarianism is a healthy lifestyle. It's more fear of food, that whole thing that red meat is bad for you. And then there are people who don't eat meat because it's against their morals. Well, there's nothing you can do with people like that. I've often wondered to myself, does a vegetarian look forward to dinner ever?" "I don't think we were as afraid of food in the early days, except for pesticides. I do take some steps. I wash everything I eat in hot water. Now there's worry about irradiation and bioengineering, but I think the critics are often short on facts." Such pronouncements upset and confused many of her followers, who wanted to believe that Julia Child was always perfect according to their worldview. When she declined to criticize irradiated food, for instance, one fan felt betrayed. "You, of all my favorite people." And it goes on from there. I wrote Julia's memoir a decade ago, and then that inspired half of the movie Julie and Julia, which came out in 2009. And then I went on to do other things. I'm a journalist, a freelance writer, like Daniel, and I write on a lot of different things. And I did a series of articles and books on the environment and energy policy. But there were a few questions in the back of my mind that had lingered from writing the memoir. Julia had died in 2004, and so she wasn't around to ask. But so I started to poke around in her archives, which are at the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe. It's a phenomenal trove there. And I was wondering about what happened after the period we talk about in the memoir. Once they had moved back to the States, were living on Irving Street in Cambridge, what was their life like? How did she get on television, and how did she become so successful so quickly? What had happened to the films that she had shot, the documentary films she had shot in France in 1970, detailed the traditional French foods and chefs and the things that inspired her originally. She shot a series of short documentaries about the hand cutting of meat, the making of pastry, the baking of bread, and they were spliced into season 2 of The French Chef. So I just cold called WGBH and said, "Do you happen to know where those old documentary films are?" And there was a long silence on the end of the phone, and then the researcher said, "You know, it's amazing that you just called, but we were recently on some back stairway. We found these dusty old rusted canisters of film, and we were going to throw them out, but we figured we better take a look at them first." And there was one machine left in the building that could actually play the old film. They took a look at it, and it was Julia in France. And so I rushed up here, had a look at the films, and they're fabulous. And that great super saturated color from 1970s, Julia dressed quite chicly, showing her audience the things that had inspired her. GBH, by the way, is now digitizing those, which is great. But that got me really thinking, so I started digging around in the archives, and I thought, well, I could put together a short documentary of my own using those clips, or maybe write an article. But the more I looked, the more I found. And a picture began to emerge of Julia in the 70s that I had not been aware of before. And I assumed that if I didn't know about it, then probably most other people didn't know about it. And the picture was of this moment when she very consciously got away from France and the French Chef, reinvents herself as Julia Child, and finds her true voice, and goes on to have greater success than ever. She was paid the ultimate American compliment. She was spoofed on television, first as Julia Grown Up on The Electric Company, and then most famously by Dan Aykroyd, who I interviewed for this book and is a lovely guy and is a big foodie and has a very funny story about the making of two skits. The first was the insane Bassomatic 76 skit, inspired by Julia and her cuisine art. And the second was the famous, save the liver. Now, Julia didn't like mean humor, but she did appreciate Dan's impersonation. In fact, she kept the videotape of that show on her TV here in Cambridge. And at the end of a long dinner party, once in a while, she would put her head back and say, save the liver. And what's amazing about that is that skit aired in 1978. And it helped to define Dan Aykroyd's career. It helped to define SNL as a show. And to this day, it helps to define Julia Child. I can't tell you how many people, especially people younger than me, who probably weren't even alive then, know Julia through that crazy skit. And it's amazing. And I think probably because they replayed it in Julie and Julia, that helped. But as many of you know, Julia's Kitchen from Cambridge is now at the Smithsonian in Washington. And at the end of this month, I'll be down there. We'll be presenting the Julia Child Award, the second one we've given. Last year, Jacques Pepin won. This year, it'll be Rick Bayless, the Mexican chef, who was a friend of Julia's. And then there's a Food History Weekend. And I'll be doing a reading at the National Museum of American History there. And if anybody can make it, I highly recommend it. Julia's kitchen was taken piece by piece from her Cambridge kitchen and is now a display in that museum. It was meant to be a temporary display, but it proved so popular that it's still up years later, and they've recently revamped it, and it is now the introductory exhibit to a whole new wing of American food history, and it's really fabulous, and they have everything from a scaled-down version of Julia's Kitchen for kids to play in, to a stage with a stove on it for demonstrations, and then a huge display of Julia's crazy cookware and the kitchen itself. So I could keep going, but I think I'd better hand it over to Daniel, and then we can have a conversation, and we'd be happy to take questions or hear some stories.
All right. Thanks, Alex, and thank you all for coming. I have to make a big switch in subject in many ways. So sometimes when I think about this book, I just think about how we all inhabit a world of longing outside those windows, in this room, and then in the pages of this book, Sing for Your Life. When I first met Ryan Speeder Green, who's basically the everything of this book. It was 2011. He was competing in the Metropolitan Opera's annual contest to find the most promising emerging singers in America up to the age of 30. He came from southeastern Virginia. He had grown up in a trailer park when his mom could no longer afford the payments there. He grew up right across the street, narrow street, from a drug dealer's ramshackle headquarters in a house that was really, as his mom would describe it, barely more than a shack. He'd spent time locked up as a juvenile. But here he was, 24 years old, in the semifinals, having, you know, made it through the district and regional rounds. And he'd barely known his father growing up. Well, I should say, he tried in ways to connect with his father. He and his older brother would steal Arnold Schwarzenegger action figures from a nearby strip mall store because in one of their rare conversations, his father had claimed that he'd met Arnold once. And so in a way, this was like stealing their father back into their lives. At 24, semifinals, he manages to reach his father by phone across the country in Bakersfield, California, and explains to his father how big a deal this contest is. And his father agrees if Ryan makes it to the finals, his father will somehow make it across the country to hear him sing opera for the first time. So many notes of longing. Ryan's mother, I just want to read you a tiny bit of what Ryan said to me early on as he and I were getting to know each other. As he explained to me the volatility and violence in their house, volatility and violence that ran in all directions. She's had an awful life. To survive, she built a wall surrounding herself. It got built steadily. She built it for everyone and everything except her children. And then she had to build a wall for me, between her and me. A child can only do so much before that wall gets built. I know that. No mom is going to forget. My child threatened my life and probably would have done it if given the chance. And now, 2011 semifinals, he was singing for her, singing to break down that wall. Another note of longing. Early on, and then steadily more and more over the years between 2011 and now, Ryan and I were able to have candid and complex conversations about race. And one of the things that emerged so powerfully was his yearning to sing with such nuance, with such beauty, and with such power. And of course, as you all know, there's no amplification in an opera hall, and the Met is a huge opera hall, even by opera theater standards. So it's about, 60-70% bigger than most of the great halls of Europe. I mean, if you or I stand on that stage and try to cry out to the farthest reaches, our voice is going to flutter to the ground somewhere between here and there. So that tremendous nuance has to be combined with tremendous power. And for Ryan, this was an attempt to sing past color, to transcend the preconceptions and the prejudices that affect, no matter how we might like to think otherwise, no matter how the people inside the Met building, 98% of whom voted for Obama twice, would like to think otherwise, affects the way we hear. What we see, race, affects the way we hear, and the very few African-American opera singers, Eric Owens would be one if you're familiar with opera, would say this emphatically. And so this was part of Ryan's mission, part of Ryan's longing. Now, I should say, we live in a world and in a time when racial identity, in a way, trumps everything. So it's important to note that, while it's easy to categorize opera as a white art form, Ryan, I wish you were here, we do lots of events together, identifies fiercely as African American, and we'll get to the story later, but, as it happened, after he was locked up, through almost sheer happenstance and serendipity, wound up in this school, half-day school of the arts. School of the arts takes a trip to New York. He's by then been taken under wing by an African-American voice teacher at that school, and he's taken to see Carmen at the Met. Well, that night it happened that the mezzo-soprano, African-American, Denise Graves, is singing, and Ryan is transfixed. And Mr. Brown, his teacher, knows Denise Graves, takes the kids backstage. Denise Graves gives Ryan a hug, and this is like the transformative moment of his life. He walks across the plaza with Mr. Brown and declares, unable to sing, read a score at that point, I'm going to sing at the Met someday. Mr. Brown laughs at him. I'll tell you more about what ensued later. But the point is, then in 2011, and now in 2016, we're going to play a little bit of him in a sec. All the self, all the soul, and equally importantly, all the craft and all the art that he pours into his music is in some way an attempt to so overwhelm his listeners, to so connect with them so deeply that race is transcended. Given all that, impossible for me to walk away from this story. People often ask, why do you want to write about it? How could I not want to write about it? But despite all the ways in which Ryan was and is trying to connect through his art, despite all the urgent ways that I'm trying to connect through mine, he and I did not connect right away. So this started for me with a story for the New York Times Magazine. I was following the Met contest from the district rounds all over the country. Semifinals are approaching, And I write to the, by email to the 22 semifinalists and say, tell me something about your lives, your relationship to music, whatever you want. And everybody writes back, some of them 3-5 pages, of course, because New York Times Magazine, you know, this is a chance. Maybe they're going to get their career jump-started. Every one of those singers except one, Ryan Speedo Green, not a word. They all get to New York, and I get to the Met, and I'm hovering around. Days leading up to the semifinals, people are seeking me out. I'm having no trouble finding those who don't. All except one. Not a bit of contact with Ryan Speedo Green. He thought he had no chance to get to the finals, or little chance anyway. The finals are a formal packed house concert at the Met, tuxedo required. He hadn't even brought his tuxedo to New York. And no one at the Met was saying, hey, look out for Ryan Speedo Green. He's one of the ones who might win. He's someone who might actually have a career. None of that. So I didn't think a thing of it. A lot's happened since then, but I want to read to you just a tiny bit from the beginning of the book. Ryan Speedo Green did not belong here. He didn't belong in the hotel room they had booked for him, where the headboard was high and plush and the light was faintly gold. There was more gold in the lobby, lots of it. The shimmering antique frame of the huge mirror beside the elevators, the austere silk curtains that rose 3 stories toward the vaulted ceiling, the velvet of the deeply curved couches, the abstract sculpture at the turn of the stairs. Each time he left the lobby, passing under the hotel's marquee and facing Lincoln Center in the middle of New York City, he felt even less at home. He climbed the broad steps to the Lincoln Center Plaza and was surrounded by towering white stone columns that made him think of ancient stadiums, Olympians competing for Zeus's pleasure, and gladiators battling one another for survival. At the far side of the square stood the Opera Hall. This was the home of the Met, the greatest opera company in the country. The building looked as grand and remote as the White House. As he started to traverse the plaza, the fountain ahead of him was almost inaudible. But as he neared the circular pool, the countless silvery plumes of shooting water created not a loud trickle or a concentrated splash. The heavy plumes produced a crescendo of sound that compounded the anxiety or thrill he felt on any given crossing of the square. It was a crossing he made repeatedly during those few days in the early spring of 2011, leading up to the semifinals of the contest. Behind him, the clamor of the fountain hushed swiftly. In front of him were the giant poster stands, the posters announcing the season's productions, lead singers photographed in dramatic shadow, and the Opera House, the series of archways, the excess of glass, the vast murals with their airborne goddesses, their harp, cello, violins, horns. Beyond the windows hung an array of chandeliers with their pinpoints of pale gold light, and beyond the chandeliers was an aura of darker gold. Backstage, awaiting his turn to sing, Ryan definitely did not belong. But there he was on the Sunday of the semis. This was the most revered competition in America for would-be opera stars. 22 singers had made it this far after the district and regional rounds. Ryan was slotted 18th of the 22 for his minutes in front of the judges. He listened to the others. He couldn't escape their voices as he sat in the common area outside the dressing rooms where their performances were piped in. But it wasn't only the voices themselves that confirmed how misplaced he was. It was the backgrounds of the other semifinalists. One had begun vocal training at 7, another at 8. His rivals brandished the invisible badges of having studied at the country's most prestigious conservatories, at Curtis or the Academy of Vocal Arts or Juilliard. They not only belonged, for years they had been destined for this moment here at the Met. Ryan's home in southeastern Virginia was as much a shack as a house with bullet holes above his mother's bedroom window. Before that, he'd grown up in a trailer park. Before that, in low-income housing. Along the way, he spent time locked up in Virginia's institution of last resort for juveniles judged to be a threat to themselves or to everyone around them. And Ryan was black. There was one other African-American among the selected 22, but she'd had a much different upbringing. A part of him, a driven, half-conscious part, saying to make race disappear. Like Alex, there's a ton I want to say, but I'm going to skip past everything that Ryan and I in tandem learned together about this and this and this and how you create amazing sound out of it. Of course, Ryan learning that in a physical way and I learning it in a way that I could translate onto the page. I just want to have you hear like a minute, 30 seconds of Ryan singing. This is to leap way forward. So he is in a lead role in La Boheme at the Metropolitan Opera right now. Opening night was a couple weeks ago. Denise Graves came. This is Ryan singing at the very end of the opera. It's sort of the climax. It's the story of a small group of bohemian artists in Paris, struggling, starving. Mimi, the girlfriend of one of the artists, is dying of consumption, and Ryan, a philosopher playing the role of Colline, is about to sell his treasured overcoat, in which, as he sings, he's kept all his favorite books, the poets, the philosophers who are closest to his heart. And so he sings this ode to his coat, but it's actually kind of an ode to everything that these artists are about to lose, their dreams and the life of this beloved woman, Mimi.
Again, everybody, this is the Extraordinary Lives panel. Our guests today are Daniel Bergner, talking about Sing for Your Life, a story of race, music, and family. I'm going to get this right this time, Alex. Alex Prudhomme, the author of The French Chef in America, Julia Child's Second Act. And I am Erica Morrison, producer for NPR and WBUR's Here and Now. Okay, so I neglected to talk about the violence that led up to him going to juvenile and just really kind of structured his life and where he was and why he had all this anger. Can you talk about a little bit about that?
Sure. So, I mean, this was a violent household. Valerie's mom is in some ways a really impressive woman. I've gotten to know her well, but she was certainly also a violent woman with her kids. by the time, even when Ryan was in early elementary school or mid-elementary school, he was put in this special classroom for the six or seven most out-of-control kids in the entire school district. When I talked to his principal, who had just retired after a 42-year career, she was like, oh, yes, I remember Ryan very well. You know, just picture this for one example. I mean, he, you know, there were times when his teacher would clear out the classroom, leaving Ryan alone as a way to just, you know, sort of rescue the rest of the kids. So even before he, even before he's taken under wing by Mr. Brown, who I mentioned, he has this pint-size special classroom teacher, Mrs. Hughes. He throws his desk at her the first day. She says to him, you can learn from the floor since your desk is there. This impresses him because she's the first person who just hasn't instantly kind of given up on him. She teaches her kids, she's white, predominantly the kids are African American. She's just straining for some way to bridge this. Teaches her kids the I Have a Dream speech, makes them memorize it, not only to make a, not only to bridge the racial gap, but also to just say to them, like, this is a chance to transform your character, to be judged by your character, which you do control. And even though it's after that that he gets locked up and he would say emphatically, you know, transformations do not happen all at once, this is still something he refers back to. And, you know, Mrs. Hughes was there on opening night, and he still talks about wanting his journey to be like this tiny emblem of King's vision.
And Alex, you mentioned some of Julia's friends, and a lot of the book focuses on Julia and company and the different friends that she had and kind of who made her who she was towards the end of her career, or not made her who she was, but definitely played a role in her legacy. Can you talk a little bit about her friendships?
Sure. Well, one of the reasons that Paul and Julia, when they retired from the diplomatic service in 1961, chose to live in Cambridge is that they had friends there. And Julia particularly liked what she called the eggheads, the intellectuals, many of whom had come from Eastern Europe during the Second World War and were teaching at Harvard or MIT or BC or BU. And they moved into this extraordinary neighborhood where in the space of a few blocks were, you know, Arthur Schlesinger and Galbraith and all sorts of really interesting intellectuals. And there was a cross-pollination that happened there where Paul and Julia influenced their neighbors and their neighbors influenced them. I think the most outstanding example of that is Ben and Jane Thompson, who many of you probably have heard of. Ben Thompson was an architect and led the Harvard architecture program. He founded one of the first design stores in America. It was called Design Research. And in fact, little known fact, the Marimekko prints that they imported, the tableware, the flatware, and so on, that they sold in the store, they used to decorate the French Chef set. And back then, it was very low key, very low budget, and they would load up a station wagon with all that stuff from the store, take it to GBH, they would decorate the set, Julia would do her show, they would load it back in the station wagon, take it back to the store, and try to sell it. The Thompsons also founded Harvest Restaurant, which still exists, and it's a fabulous training ground for many of Boston's leading chefs. Julia and Paul were frequent customers there. I've had a number of women chefs tell me that because of Julia's support, Boston writ large had a tremendous number of female chefs. And it's interesting, Julia never liked the label of feminist. She rejected the bra burning and the radical words of Gloria Steinem and Jane Fonda, but she was obviously a very important role model for many women and men, and led by example, and just showed that you could pretty much do whatever you wanted to do within certain limits, as long as you really pursued your passion and you took it seriously. Ben and Jane Thompson then went on to be the catalyst for the revitalization of Faneuil Hall, which Paul and Juliet helped with. So this is just one couple that happens to live down the street where the hand-in-glove partnership with Paul and Julia ended up having a huge kind of cultural impact, this was no ordinary community. So, to your point, that their friendships were very important. And certainly, they were influenced by their friends, too.
Yeah. Speaking of friends, how did you become his friend, Ryan's friend, Daniel? You said that he didn't open up to you easily, but when you read the book, you see that you guys had a very intimate friendship where he really opened up about race and his family and things that he hadn't really shared with many people.
Yeah. Well, he tells the story, and I think he's probably accurate, that somewhere along after I'd heard him sing in the semifinals and, you know, heard this voice, which was still raw in some ways, but really velvety and rich, I said, look, just let's go out to lunch, 45 minutes, that's it. And he agreed and found himself stuck there for 3 hours. So partly it was just being what journalists do and being relentless. But I don't know. I mean, there was just partly it's just this rhythm of asking, listening, imagining, going home, transcribing, thus listening again, and then asking again. Partly maybe it's just recognizing how different we were. Let's just start with the obvious, you know, black, white, 6'5", and what he sees as tiny. I always take a little bit of offense to that, really tiny. But then a completely different sense of what it means to survive and to excel. You know, my world is like, dig up the past, go for some therapy, you know, grapple with your past and you'll be set free, right? He comes from a completely other place on that, and we would run into this from time to time. Like, for him, it's like about moving forward, like close that door and get away. And so periodically he would say, that's enough for today. We can come back to it, but that's enough. And one of the interesting things to me was just reckoning with how different the visions of psychological sort of exploration and health are. Like his really was, let me keep moving forward. That's worked for me since the age of 15. I'm gonna keep on going. So I think in answer to your question, part of it was just recognizing the differences and letting those differences just feed what we were working on.
Okay, I'm going to open up the floor for questions. Do we have any questions?
How about some stories? I know some of you knew Julia.
I ran into her at the grocery store.
Ah.
Well, she bought.
Oh. You weren't the person who actually ran into her, were you? Okay, so here's a story about Savinor's, which is not too far from here, where Julia used to shop. One day, Julia was shopping at Savinor's, and a young woman was following her around and did what you did, was buying everything that Julia bought, and had no idea what it was until she got home and opened her bag and looked into it. But the way she met Julia was she had come into the store and was looking down at her shopping list, and suddenly somebody rammed into her from behind with a shopping cart, and it was Julia. Who was doing the same thing. They collided, and then the woman followed her around the rest of the afternoon, and then she got home, and she had all these random things, and she thought, well, you know, if Julia can make something, I think she kind of put together a dinner based on whatever random things Julia had bought for her.
And Daniel, can you tell a story about when Ryan went to the Met party for the fundraiser, and he didn't want to sing a certain song?
Right. So most of you, I'm going to hope, know the song Old Man River. So as Ryan begins to sing opera, and starts to sing with some glimmer of success late in high school. Gives these concerts or plays these roles, and then afterward, inevitably, someone, white, comes up to him and says, "Do you know Paul Robeson? Do you know William Warfield? You embody those singers. Won't you sing Old Man River?" This happens in high school. It happens when he gets into college and goes off and continues his education. Happens at the Met. And it haunts him because although it's a beautiful song, it is also a song, as you know, about, it's in Paul Robeson's version, you know, a large, strong black man reduced to next to nothing, and singing about being reduced to next to nothing and wishing for death as a release to being next to nothing. And Ryan sings this at a summer festival. The show stops. It has to stop mid-show because the white audience stands and applauds and won't stop applauding until he sings it again. And he's haunted because he's thinking not only, wow, I'm a classical singer. What is this thing? Why can't I be seen and heard as that? But he's also thinking, why is it that white audiences take such deep pleasure in hearing a big black man singing about being reduced? He's like, no, black audiences might listen to this once, but they're not going to jump up and say, sing it again. And finally, he's at this party for Met patrons, and everyone's compelled, the singers are each compelled to sing, stand at the piano and sing, and Ryan sings a show tune, and then everyone's encore, 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 and he says, "I don't have anything prepared," and the pianist says, "Why don't you sing Old Man River, and why don't you sing the PG version so you don't offend anyone?" So I'm not going to get this quite right, but he transforms it from white man to big boss so no one will be too uncomfortable, and he's like, wow, this is going from horrible to triply horrible, and the whole thing ends up in sort of this climactic moment of abasement, even though he's singing beautifully. But, you know, for Ryan, this encapsulates the struggles and the journey he has to make, again, to be heard the way he needs to be heard and to inhabit the path of a singer that is expansive rather than, you know, putting him in a box. Thanks.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the risks you take as a journalist and how you blend sort of journalism with sort of more poetic voice and also like sort of some of the issues you had with the warden and some of the political kind of...
Well, okay, so not everyone's going to be aware of this book, so I'm going to do this super fast, but of course I'm flattered, so I can't resist. so... So she asked about the first nonfiction book I did called God of the Rodeo, which is where I spent about a year and a half going there for about 8 days a month at Louisiana's maximum security prison. It's called Angola, and they had an annual, now it's biannual, inmate rodeo. The inmates are untrained. It has this gladiatorial element because bucking broncos and particularly bulls are pretty dangerous animals, and tells the story of a very controversial warden and then this group of five inmates who I followed from the year, through the year. Quickly dangerous places. I guess you're referring to that, also to covering civil wars. I don't know. I mean, I'm usually trying to get to know people more than I am trying to, like, get in the line of fire. So there is a difference, really. I'm not a photographer, so I don't literally have to have bullets whizzing past. And you know, it's about creating some kind of personal connection, which is, you know, part of what I'm talking about here. And it's really nice what you said about the poetic literary voice. Yes, I mean, that is so important to me to be telling a story in a way where the language, you know, rises to the level of what I'm dealing with, which even at Angola, even at a maximum security prison, had actually an element of beauty. And that would be a whole nother discussion. But yes, thank you.
Anyone else? Yes, sir? I'm sorry, can you get to the microphone? Do you have the microphone?
No, we can't hear you.
There's one, no.
Alex, forgive me if you mentioned this already. I came in a little late. Is it true that Julia didn't particularly care for Julie Powell's book, Julie and Julia?
People always ask that. So the question is about the movie Julie and Julia.
The book, actually. Did she live long enough to see the movie?
No. The movie was inspired half by the memoir that Julia and I wrote together, My Life in France, and it was also inspired by a book called Julie and Julia, written by Julie Powell. And that was a book that came out of a blog she wrote. She decided to cook all of the recipes in Mastering the Art of French Cooking in the space of a year and blog about it. Now, she was not the first person to do this. I think many other people had done it, but she was the first to blog about it. And in 2004, roughly, when I was working with Julia, Julie Powell apparently called Julia and asked what she thought, or her publisher called, or something like that. And in the movie, which was written by Nora Ephron, there's a kind of a dramatic scene in which Julie Powell thinks that that Julia Child has somehow dismissed her, kind of rudely, that she was inconsequential. And I think there's a little poetic license there to answer your question briefly. Julia was 91 years old. Her health was waxing and waning. She was in a retirement community in Santa Barbara. She was working with me on her memoir. She was very busy. People were constantly coming by and calling. She didn't really know what a blog was. She'd never heard of Julie Powell. And so I don't think that she really dismissed Julie Powell. She just, it didn't register for her in real life. There was an additional thing, which is that Julia would make her recipes 10 or 12 times to work out all the kinks. And sometimes the recipes run a little long because she explains in them what to do if something goes wrong and how to correct it. And so she knew that these were pretty bulletproof. If you do what Julia instructs you to do, it will turn out great, I can guarantee that. If you start to freelance, then you're on your own. But Julie Powell made much ado in her blog about not being able to do Julia's recipes. And I think that that must have influenced Julia, because I'm assuming, and I wouldn't want to put words in her mouth, but that she didn't take Julie Powell seriously as a cook. And, you know, when you're at the end of your life, you're busy, it just didn't register. So that's the longish answer to that one. But hey, for the movie, no problem. You know, one thing about that movie is when I first heard about the idea, I was a little disappointed because I was thinking that our book would make a pretty good movie just on its own. But I think Nora Ephron was smart to combine Julie Powell's story with Julia's story. It works dramatically. There's a counterpoint. Julia and Paul had this kind of amazing marriage that I tell my friends, don't try to emulate that because you'll never be able to do it. And Julie Powell and her husband were fighting, and they had a very kind of a grittier marriage, I would say. And having that young couple in the film brought a whole new cohort of people to Julia Child's teaching and her books. And if you go to the Smithsonian, where her kitchen is now, you'll see people of all ages and races and creeds there just getting stuck at that kitchen. It's just it's a magnet for people. So I think in the end, it was the right decision by Nora to do that. And I'm grateful for it because it has extended Julia's legacy in a way.
Will there be a movie for this book?
We can only hope so. Anybody out there? No. The book's just come out, and it usually takes a little while. The Hollywood knuckleheads tend to think, well, there was one Julia movie, why do we need another one? My response is that this is a totally different book. It's a totally different time of life, different place, different set of issues, and there's plenty of drama there. In fact, there's probably more drama in this book than in the memoir, because it's later in her life when there are health issues, and she reaches the peak of her celebrity, and it is just as inspiring as the first one.
Daniel, is there any movie options over there?
Not yet.
Not yet.
There's hope.
Okay, we've got 1 minute left. Do you guys have any closing words?
Wow, that's pressure. Mm-hmm. Ready for closing words. And I can't, after Ryan's singing, I can't burst into song, not sanely anyway. I think I'll just inhabit Ryan for a sec here, since he's right now on his way. In the midst of the Boheme role, he's actually singing two others in the States. He's mostly in Vienna now, so that's like one of the top five opera houses in the world. Singing major roles there. He came to the States for Boheme, packed in, singing the Toreador in Carmen in San Antonio. So he couldn't be here. So I think, I've been really, really touched. He says he's read the book four times and really wants people to share his story, to know his story, to know about these teachers that affected his life, and we haven't even talked about the Met teachers. So I think all I can say is read it, write to us. I'll, send along questions to Ryan, and thanks for listening.
That's a great story, an important story, and I hope that he's inspiring other young African-American singers to go into it. I thought I would just quickly read you a little section from the very end of our book, my book. This is a section called Child's Play, and it kind of gets to the core of Julia, I think. So throughout her career, journalists often like to note how childlike Julia Child could be and how she loved to play with food, and it was true. Her audience laughed when she dropped a potato pancake on the stove, then scooped it back into the pan, saying, "When you're alone in the kitchen, who's to know?" Sorry, Julia, that's a terrible imitation. She flirted with David Letterman while blowtorching a raw hamburger, made winking double entendres on Good Morning America, and summoned Jacques Pepin to the stove with a honking duck call. She encouraged this vision of childlike play to a point, but it could be misleading. As Paul knowingly observed, practically every article on Julia has concentrated on the clown instead of the woman, the cook, the expert, or the revolutionary. There was another Julia, one who saw something deeper, more profound, and mysterious in our ability to turn raw ingredients into something delicious to eat, and how life-altering that experience can be. I was reminded of this when I happened to glance at a postscript in Julia Child and Company. It was a short, easily overlooked aside titled On Playing with Your Food. I read it expecting to laugh, yet something about it, the tone, the celebration of cooking as art, the encouragement and inclusiveness of its message, caught my attention. I read it again and then again. I realized that Julia's lighthearted title masked a heartfelt cri de cœur, one that makes a fitting epitaph. Julia writes, "Some children like to make castles out of their rice pudding or faces with raisins for eyes. It is forbidden, so sternly that when they grow up, they take a horrid revenge by dyeing meringues pale blue or baking birthday cakes in the form of horseshoes or lyres or whatnot. That is not playing with food, that is trifling. Play, to me, means freedom and delight, as in the phrase, play of imagination. If cooks did not enjoy speculating about new possibilities in every method and each raw material, their art would stagnate and they would become rote performers, not creators. True cooks love to set one flavor against another in the imagination, to experiment with the great wealth of fresh produce in the supermarkets, to bake what previously they braised, to try new devices. We all have flops, of course, but we learn from them, and when an invention or variation works out at last, it is an enormous pleasure to propose it to our fellows. Let's all play with our food, I say, and in so doing, let us advance the state of the art together.
Alex Prudhomme is the author of The French Chef in America, Julia Child's Second Act. Daniel Bergner is the author of Sing for Your Life, A Story of Race, Music, and Family. They'll both be outside signing books and talking to you folks. I'm Erica Morrison. I'm a producer with WBUR's Here and Now. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks, Erica.
There goes my mic.